Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Bonnie Kay, and welcome to the Straight Wives Talk Show. This is a hard-hitting show that discusses the complexity of marriages between straight women to gay and bisexual men. Each week, my guests and I discuss issues that affect over 4 million women in this country and millions more around the world who find themselves unknowingly married to a gay or bisexual man. If you have any questions you'd like to send in during this broadcast, you can email me at bonkay@aol.com. That's bonkaye@aol.com. Tonight I have a very special guest that I would like to introduce, and her name is Alexa Servadidio. Alexa is a therapist in New York, and I had the wonderful experience of meeting her a couple of years ago. Alexa has been on our show before. And Alexa really works a lot with individuals, couples, and families in her therapy practice and relating to a lot of different traumas that people are going through. And she has a wonderful computer television show as well as her own radio blog talk show and really working on helping people to heal. And recently Alexa came out with her first book, Finding Your Peace Within the Chaos. And it's a beautiful book, how to help people heal from different situations. And so I'd like to welcome Alexa back to our show. Alexa, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me back. It's such a pleasure. I always love coming on your show. Thank you so much.
And I love having you here because you always give us such wonderful insight. If ever there was a time when healing is needed, Alexa, I hate to start the show on a down note, but I really feel that we're in such troubled times right now. You know, the events that happened in the past week, the events that happened in Orlando, you know, the murder of all the people who were in the bar, the killing of the singer from New Jersey, little boy, the alligator. I mean, it just seems that every day the horrific tragedies are happening. And it's so hard sometimes really have the faith that you need to get you through these situations. But I know that on top of being a wonderful therapist and somebody who is really excellent at helping people with healing, you also have strong religious beliefs and really do believe that there can be a better world if people just do the right thing. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. I totally believe in that. And I think sometimes, you know, we don't know why all of these horrific things happen, but I try to focus on how to heal from it and also to see how beautiful it is to see people come together and support.
Hello? Oh, I lost Alexa. Well, hopefully she'll be calling right back in. And as I mentioned to you, it's just been a really horrific week for many people because of the fact that so many tragedies are taking place. And I even felt myself shaken this week, and it takes a lot, but it just seemed like one thing after the other in the news. And looking at all those beautiful people who are no longer with us and for no reason at all. And I think sometimes it's really hard for people to have faith. And that's what I love about Alexa. She's always there offering support and offering answers. So let me get Alexa back on.
Yes.
Here you are,
hi.
Alexa.
How are you? Yes, sorry.
That's quite fine.
It's just so incredible. I think sometimes you really see how people have come together and really, you know, for people they don't even know, just the extra mile, really caring and opening their hearts and their homes and everything to other people. I think focusing on that, and unfortunately sometimes these horrible things have to happen in order for people to really see what's, you know, put life in perspective and really come to really start caring and being there for each other.
Yes, and I guess that shows you that there is good in this world, the fact that there was just an overwhelming response, and you love to see that, and it does give you that encouragement. But it just shows you today, and I think that your book, Finding Your Peace Within the Chaos, really helps people understand that there is a lot of chaos in this world today. And people are reacting in ways that we may not have realized so much before. And I don't know if it's because we're just more exposed to this now, Alexa, that things really are actually this much worse than they were 100 years ago or 50 years ago. I know that I keep posting on my Facebook page, my personal page, all these pictures from memories from the 1940s and 50s when times were simpler. And I tell people I'm really glad that I grew up when I did because it was an age of somewhat innocence. I mean, certainly we'd have problems and we had conflicts, but not the way things are today. Do you think things have changed through technology and other problems or...
Yes, yes. I think definitely through technology, I think values have changed. I definitely think, you know, God has been taken out of everything. And I think, yes, it's important for self-care and for each individual to take care of themselves. But I think a lot of times that people have misconstrued that idea and have really, you know, about, you know, really doing what's good for them. And I think, but it's really about, you know, thinking about what's good for everyone, but still doing self-care for yourself, but having, you know, the different beliefs and the different morals. And I think also with technology, you can be accessed at any time, and you're exposed to so many different things that many, many years ago you weren't exposed to. And I think that also takes up family time. A lot of times kids or people, all adults are on the computers or social media, where a lot of times we didn't have that. People were spending family time together and bonding one-on-one in person with people instead of strangers over the Internet.
I think that's so true, that you just don't have the same kind of interpersonal connections with people. I see that young people today have loads of Internet friends that they've never met. And there's not even like a sense of reality because you're really not establishing the same kind of relationships. And yet, it's very hard for me to, every place you go, and I know, you know, I also teach and I see it in the classroom before class starts, it seems everybody's on their cell phone communicating. Is that such? You can have a bunch of people in a room. Nobody's talking. They're just on their cell phones communicating. So I think we've lost a lot of the art of communication with others, and a lot of misunderstandings come about that way. But I think we're living in troubled times, and your book really addresses so many of the social issues that come up. And, of course, for many of our own women, this book is so valuable because you're addressing issues in here that some of the women are experiencing. You know, some of these, all of the women are experiencing some problems, and some of them you're addressing specifically, and others are just general, but we can learn so much from you. And so, you know, this book came about from your television, computer television show from your guests originally and radio guests, is that correct?
Yes, yes. It came from different questions that I've had from listeners and case studies from the years.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, all names and identifying information was changed around, so nothing
mm-hmm.
really could be identified. But I think all of these different questions, these different topics, can hit home for everyone in some way. It's everything from, you know, a young teen cutting versus suicide to, you know, maintaining peer relationships to sexting as a teenager to, you know, couples therapy to domestic violence to bipolar versus borderline up to the heroin epidemic. And I think it's at different stages and really about, you know, paying attention and really being aware and feeding yourself emotionally, physically, mentally, verbally, spiritually, and taking care of yourself and kind of being well-rounded with that, but also finding a community, a team, and being able to reach out to other people and be supportive.
So, Alexa, maybe you can talk a little bit first. Let's go start at the beginning from the first chapter of the teenagers cutting themselves, because
yes.
we've had women who are part of our network who have come to me in this situation where they're really concerned about their teenagers with cutting, tattooing. One woman who I'm very close to, she said that her daughter had a semicolon tattooed on her wrist, which is an indication of depression,
mm-hmm.
fighting for depression. You know, it's a different world today. When you have children going through traumas, because when families are breaking up or they're broken families, many of them are affected by this, correct?
Yes. Yes, I find a lot of the teens and preteens that I'm seeing that are doing the cutting. There's, you know, either bullying in school, some conflict at home, and I also find not always associated, but I find especially with young girls, if there's cutting, I always want to rule out eating disorder and if there's ever been any sexual abuse or trauma, because unfortunately that triad is very common, and I think a lot of times these teens also, their peers are cutting and saying, hey, try this. This is what goes on. I think also with all these social websites with these tattoos that, yes, they're at the strength and people should not be ashamed where there's a stigma for being depressed or having anxiety, but I think sometimes it almost encourages people, it gives them ideas at a state where they're not strong enough to make maybe those decisions, but they want to feel part of it and do these tattoos or do the cutting to kind of release the pain and kind of gain some control back in their life.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was just curious in your opinion. I talk to many friends of mine who are teachers in the public school system, and I'm in a large city in Philadelphia. And, of course, New York has a large system. I know you're out in the suburbs. But the thing is this. A lot of the kids today, which is different than when I was growing up, many of them, like some schools, they tell me half or even up to three-quarters are on some kind of medication for children. From the time they're little babies, you know,
mm-hmm.
toddlers, they're being put on medication for all kinds of disorders, ADHD, depression, bipolar, you know, from the time they're little children up. Do you think this is having an impact?
Well, I think sometimes medication, I think sometimes things, it's too freely given. I think sometimes it's
mm-hmm.
an answer or parents aren't that educated or that everybody else is doing it. This is, you know, why try this if the behavior is really bad? And I think medication doesn't solve the problem. It can take the edge off. It can gain, you know, deal with some of the impulse control. But you also have to find out what is triggering this person for their behaviors. It's not just the medication. And I think starting at such a young age, are we, you know, numbing it down? Are we putting a Band-Aid over instead of really finding out, yes, maybe there's something that was an ADHD or some brain issues that, you know, the medication and there's some, you know, not misconnections going on, but I think you really need to be able to watch it over time. And I think trauma presents itself in many different forms and can look as different disorders. When what I found with a lot of my clients, young and old, once the trauma is addressed, the disturbing behaviors, the acting out behaviors, maybe even the psychosis that people think it is, really disappears once the trauma has been healed and worked through.
And I think that's really the key, is finding the appropriate help. And I think a lot of people don't even know where to begin for that. So maybe you can give some insight. Let's say your child is cutting, or let's say you notice something's not quite right. Where do you start?
I think, one, you know, I would speak to their guidance counselor. I would speak to their teachers. find out what's going on in school, see if there's any acting out behaviors in school. Are they, you know, any drugs or alcohol? Has there been any bullying? And I think then, you know, taking them, you know, for a psychiatric evaluation, just to make sure. I think, you know, cutting doesn't always lead to suicide. They're not, it's not, you know, most of the time not the same thing. But the danger with cutting is you do it so many times, one of those times you're gonna cut a main vein or really cut yourself so deeply that you could commit suicide. So I think that's what happens. And more they cut, the deeper and deeper it goes, the more serious, you know, their tolerance of it gets worse and worse, and they're able to go, you know, a little bit bigger each time. So that becomes dangerous. So definitely going in for therapy and working on that and trying to find out what the trigger is, how it got started, and really sitting down with your teen or your young one, because this is not something that they just grow out of. This is something that will follow them. I have a lot of women that are in their 50s and 60s now who have been cutters their whole life. They've stopped many years, but if something's really triggering in their 40s or 50s, they'll start cutting every once in a while. And maybe now that they work in the office, they can't do it on their wrists, but they'll do it on their inner thighs, they'll do it on their stomach, just to kind of get back when they're really in desperate places and they're feeling so out of control.
One of the chapters in your book, and if you don't mind, I'd just like to read a few paragraphs here because I think it's so relevant to what many of our children are going through. And, of course, one of the traumas of having a straight gay marriage is, of course, when they break up, is that you are coming from a broken home, and a lot of times marriages stay together longer than they should be because people are afraid of making that change because it's going to affect the children. And I always say that, as Dr. Phil always, I quote him, that it's better to come from a broken home than live in a broken home. And in your book, under couples therapy, you have this chapter, you know, about wonderful stuff in here, but you say, I find that most couples have kind of a dance, meaning they go back and forth, which is the cycle of how they communicate and how they get through the day. One might be the pursuer, one might be the distancer, and they go back and forth with these roles. They often reenact something something out of their childhood, something that they did not resolve, or something they'd witnessed within their parents' marriage. Whether they're conscious or subconscious, they bring it into their present relationship. And then you say, if a child is witnessing chaos, abuse, trauma, addiction, it is difficult not to personalize what is happening, even if it has nothing to do with them. Obviously, it is not the child's fault, but children, no matter what age, do know what's going on. I know a lot of people think otherwise, but I have sat with 4- and 5-year-old children, and they can tell you exactly what's going on. Unfortunately, though, they often take responsibility for what the parents are going through, and that's why it's important to have a healthy couples dialogue, because you're modeling for your children how they are going to communicate on their jobs with their friends and romantic partner. And this is something that I keep trying to hit home with our own women, that they think that they're able to hide their unhappiness, or they think they're able to hide the dysfunction in the home, and they'll say to me, well, you know, I put on a brave face, or I, you know, never cry in front of my kids. And I say, come on, you think children don't pick up all these vibrations of how you're feeling? They say, you're kidding yourself. I mean, I came from a house where there was a lot of unhappiness, and my parents, of course, put on a good face until we went to bed, and that's when the arguing started, and they would think we're sleeping, but we weren't sleeping. We were listening to them argue, and we did internalize it, and we did blame ourselves. Because eventually when there's nothing left to argue about, because you can't argue on the real issues because you're hiding them, then you turn to the other issues like the children. And somehow the children get mixed into that whole mess and they do personalize it. So that's been my experience, and that's what you found also?
Yes, yes. I've found, unfortunately, a lot. And the children really do take the blame for it. And if you think, you know, with all this in a marriage, the adults have a hard time figuring out what's wrong with the marriage, and what, you know, it's so hard for an adult to carry an end of a marriage or fighting or conflict in the marriage. Imagine a child who's very young. They can't grasp the idea. Developmentally, they're not at an age where they can even think about things like that. So their first instinct is they blame themselves. Is it something I did? Maybe if I do better, or maybe this. And I think that's where the child, you know, as an adult grows up and picks, sometimes finds a partner where they can reenact, which allows them to reenact this kind of dance, where hopefully they can you know, get a better closure or, you know, have an outcome that they really like, which never, even if they did get that outcome, it still won't fill that void and that pain that they witnessed in their childhood.
Mm-hmm. And I just feel that staying in marriages that are destructive does far more harm to children. And, for instance, I have a woman right now who I know she feels terrible because she knows her marriage has to end. But in the interim, they are still together for the next few months, and her husband is being very combative with her and with the kids, and the kids are, you know, younger, but they can feel the tension, and they are personalizing it. And no matter how much, you know, she tries to reason with him, let's try to, you know, I've given her some really good conversations to have with him, you know, to try to get through this. How do you explain it to children? Because, you know, we're not going to, if, I mean, she doesn't feel they're ready to understand the whole gay issue, just the whole issue of separation. So let's just talk about the separation issue. How do you explain this to children, that it has nothing to do with them? And then they question, well, why can't you live together? Or why don't you love each other? You know, maybe you don't love me. So how do you handle that?
I think it's one really, you know, keep reinforcing the fact, even if the child says, yes, I know, it's not my fault, or yes, yes, to really keep reinforcing that it has nothing to do with the child, the parents, no matter what, if mommy and daddy fight, that never impacts how much they love their child. And I think it's saying, you know, I always say sometimes adults don't act like adults all the time. I said sometimes adults, you know, parents need mommy or daddy, need to take time or need to be by themselves to work on themselves, because sometimes they don't make the best decision, but that's what, you know, people grow up and they learn different things, but that has nothing to do with you. And kind of working with a child saying, how is that for you? Because I think any child, no matter if their parent, they have a good relationship with their parent or they don't, it's hard for them to kind of think badly that maybe something's wrong with their parent. I think a child wants to rather hold it that there's something wrong with them than this person who's supposed to love them and take care of them, and this is their safety, might not be the healthiest person to do that. So I think it's working with that and also finding the child and working with them saying, okay, you know, are there other people, someone else that, you know, is a strength for you? What are some good things about each parent? What can you count on? You know, and really working through how that even the adults have a hard time with an end of a marriage. It's something that happens. But I think it's really being, you know, open about certain things, but making sure, as of course, what children can carry and can't carry. I think some things they need to have in increments that, and some things they should not. They don't need to know all the details.
Yes, I know it's such a difficult time when the women are trying to process everything themselves, and now they're set up to a whole new life that they weren't counting on. There's a lot of frustrations, and that's why I always tell women, it's so important to find the support that you need when you're going through this so that your children don't take the brunt of it, because you're going to be angry and that's okay. You're going to need to vent and that's okay. But you need to find a therapist to do that with, or a support group or friends, so that it's not done around the children, because that's not healthy for them either. I think a lot of times, and, you know, I grew up in a family like this with my mother was a good mother, but my father was truly not. You know, he came from a very dysfunctional family himself, and it was always like divide and conquer. Who do you love more, me or your mother? And I know that I see people doing that a lot, you know, trying to have their children be their support team and be their allies. And I really feel, I mean, you can correct me if you think I'm wrong, children shouldn't have to be your support team. They should not have to pick a side when it comes to parents, even if your side is the right side. Because children really need to feel that sense of security from both parents. And I always tell my women that, you know, as angry as you are, and you may have 100% legitimate reason to feel the way you do, absolutely, but children are made up of two parents. And when you're sitting there and you're angry and knocking down one parent, I feel that child internalizes. That's part of that child and feeling that blame. Do you think I'm off key on that? Or?
No, I agree with you 100%. I think it's very damaging for a parent to really speak horribly about another parent, or this parent is really horrible and it's their fault. I think, yes, you're saying, you know, things happen and the relationship is not working out, but I think, I know it's hard not to badmouth the other person, but it's very detrimental. And I know a lot of parents, I see, they're like, I want my child to know that he's the bad one, he's the one who's done all this. Because sometimes the safer parent, the one, especially if there's domestic violence, verbal abuse, or cheating in the marriage, the one who didn't do that, the one who didn't act out, is the safer parent for the child to kind of act out on, because they know the other parent is emotionally too dangerous or not, they couldn't be that vulnerable with that parent. So they usually act out on a parent that's the safer one. And it's hard for that parent to take the brunt of it, like, you're the bad one, you told daddy to go away, it must be your fault. And sometimes, you know, it's common to say, no, your dad did this, your dad did that, he's the bad one. But I think it's hard not to do that, but really say, you know what, this is a child, and it's really being the bigger person and saying, you know, this is what's going on. Sometimes children can't carry this. As I always say, you know, therapy and some things, there's, you know, Corrie Ten Boom had a book, The Hiding Place. And there was a big suitcase, and her grandfather was carrying it, and the little girl wanted to carry it. And the grandfather said, you're too small, you can't carry it, just like in life. There's some things you can't carry. They're too heavy for you. And I think there's some things for kids are too heavy to carry for them.
Alexa, let me ask your opinion on this. How do you feel on the issue, and I'll just give you a little background first, on the issue of forgiveness, as far as when you're in a relationship with someone and you've been betrayed. And I really know that some people struggle when they're married to, and it's not just because of somebody's gay. I always say, you don't have a choice in being gay, you only have a choice in being honest. And there are some wonderful men who go into these marriages hoping they can be the husbands that their wives need them to be. They're not trying to trick them or use them. They really are hoping that they're not gay. And I'm very supportive to all these men who want to come out and do the right thing. And even if it's hurtful to the family at the moment, it's less hurtful than the long-term damage of living in a marriage where, you know, people aren't happy and setting the right role models for their children. But then there are some of these men who are married who really are sociopathic in their nature, really have borderline types of personalities, narcissism, all kinds of personality disorders, and they really torture some of their wives, you know, making them feel very emotionally abused and not physically abused. And this abuse can go on for years and years, really taking away the whole sense of who someone is. And I tell women that, you know, everybody deals with forgiveness in their own way. I've never been one to just give blind forgiveness, because for me that doesn't work, but that's not to say for other people it doesn't. But I think it's more for me, if you can give it acceptance and forgive yourself that, you know, you stayed too long, you made mistakes, you shouldn't have stayed, as, you know, you didn't see the red flags. But do you really feel it's necessary to give total forgiveness blindly?
No, I don't think it should be blindly. And I think, you know, one, if you wanted to work it out with that person, or hopefully maybe if they wanted to salvage the relationship, I think, you know, if for each person is different for what they can tolerate, what their window of tolerance is. But in order to ever do that, you have to make sure the other person is in therapy, is actively working on it, and having some time apart for that person to really work on who they are. If someone, you know, is ending the marriage, ending the relationship, and going on their own, I think it's more of almost a letting go of finding some sort of peace within themselves with it, with coming to some sort of closure. And for each person, that is so different. I work with many women and men that have been sexually abused. And, of course, you know, some of them have had, you know, the abuser has said they're sorry. Other times, that abuser will never say they're sorry. They'll never get the closure that they need. So I work a lot with them, helping them figure out what works for them. Is it writing a letter and then reading it for themselves and never sending it? You know, it takes time. There's no time limit. There's no certain way. So I think for each person is different, and what forgiveness means and what is kind of letting it go for, but you don't have to, you know, say everything's okay. But I think being able for yourself to say, I can work with myself and not hold on to the same sort of anger where it eats you up inside.
Yes, I can't even fathom when I see some of the stories here. For instance, there's a big story in this area. I don't know if you have it in your news there in New York, about a family about 10 minutes from here, 20 minutes from where I'm living. This is the news the last couple of days, that he had a large Amish family. They gave one of their daughters to this man when she was 14 years old, and he had two children with her. He's a man in his 50s. And it was his payment for helping them out financially to save their farm. Did you hear that news there?
Yes, yes. Horrible.
And I think to myself, here's a 14-year-old girl walking into a fire pit that her parents are sending her into. And at 14 years old, you know, what do you know to start with? And here you have to be molested by this man, and you have no choice, and then you, you know, get pregnant and have two children. Where do you go from there? I mean, how do you learn to live with this? I know that must be really difficult.
Yes, and I think it's really the closure and the healing is for that young girl, not for the parents, not for anything, but it's really for her growth and for her to move
mm-hmm.
forward. which I think is really important. So for each person it's different, but then it's also a lot of therapy and working through all those different stages of abuse. Excuse me.
Sure. One of the things that you mention each chapter of your book, which I think is wonderful, it looks like you're a very big believer in journaling. And I know that really works for many of our women as they're going through their pain to try to get their life back on track. In fact, last year when I had one of my healing weekends here in Philadelphia, I had a whole workshop on journaling. And it really seems to be a wonderful way to get your feelings down, express how you're feeling, seeing it as you're progressing, as you're moving through the various steps of healing, that you can physically see yourself making those changes in your writing. So you really have some wonderful suggestions on journaling in your book too, right?
Yes, yes. I think it's also really what I find with the journaling is opening up the mental dialogue about what's going on in your
mm-hmm.
life with yourself. Excuse me, sorry, just getting over a cold.
Yeah, that's fine. Don't worry about it.
And I think it's really kind of being able to start really realizing how you're feeling about things, how you want to know, what are your goals, you know, how do you feel spiritually about yourself, how you take self-care. And I find the journaling, once you write it down, it just gives it so much power when you see it on paper.
So I'm just going to read a couple of suggestions that you have for people, if you don't mind, with your journaling exercises, because in each chapter that Alexa has in the book, and these chapters deal from everything from, as we start off the book with cutting for teenagers, but it goes into infidelity in marriages, bipolar disorder, reducing emotional clutter, heroin epidemic. That was a really very moving show. I was, you know, part of that show that you had on
mm-hmm.
when you had the police authority from Connecticut talking about how heroin has become such an epidemic. And I know that certainly this is something that's affecting so many parents today, that these were things that were unheard of, to be honest with you, when I was growing up. So no matter what the problem is, there's a journaling exercise, for instance. Here you have one, write down your thoughts each day, and at the end of the week, check in with yourself emotionally, mentally, spiritually, and physically. Rate your quality of life. Write down your barriers and strengths. Really explore all those different emotions, moods, and behaviors. It's really a self-inventory. And it doesn't necessarily have to take a lot of time to do this, right?
Yes, yes. I think what the important thing is, it doesn't have to be a paragraph. It doesn't have to be, you know, like an essay. It can be just bullet points. And I think it's for you to kind of start thinking about these things and start planting the seed in your own mind on, oh, maybe I need to work on this. You know, let me think about this. And also keeping track of what your mood is like every day during the day. Because sometimes we just are so busy that we just go through the day. We don't realize that we're spending most of the day anxious or running or not feeling like we're having our needs met.
It's true. And do you suggest that people journal continually, or is there a certain amount of time each day they should devote to this, or for somebody who's new to journaling?
Yeah, I think it's different for each person. I think it's like anyone who does any creative writing or writing. I think it's getting, you know, looking at the question, thinking about it. And if you feel like you want to write something down at that moment, you can. Some people might want to think about it and sleep overnight with it. Or if you want to just journal every day and just jot down notes. And I find when you look back at your notes, and through, I think when you look back at your journal entries, you see where you are at different stages of your life. So I think these journaling exercises aren't just, okay, I do it this one time and I don't have to do them again. I think every couple of months, every couple of years, go back and look at your journal exercise and then do it while you're at a different stage of your life. And you can see the growth, you can see the mindset, and really say, wow, and get a really awareness of how you're functioning and what your quality of life is.
Alexa, last week I had a wonderful therapist who was on my show, and we were really discussing the issue. She wrote a book on improving your self-esteem. And it was a really interesting book. Her name is Dr. Marie Walker. And it's a whole workbook on how people can build up their self-esteem. How much do you feel that self-esteem has to do with so many of these issues as far as, you know, any kind of problems people are having? How is self-esteem built into that?
I think it's definitely a huge part of it. I think, you know, building your sense of self, or knowing what your sense of self, knowing who you are, what you are, and being aware of that and then developing it is so important of, you know, getting you through these difficult times. You know, saying, you know what, I'm not going to be treated like that, or I deserve better in my life. And almost kind of being aware of those negative monologues that you have in your head, or things you kind of just put up with because you feel like you should just put up with them. So I think really self-esteem has a lot. I think you're taught self-esteem by your parents, by your peers. You kind of role model what's around you. So it's really saying, you know, what is my self-esteem based on? Other people, my parents, my self-worth, and really starting to find out who you are with it. A lot of times, I young women, older women, even young men and older men come in and say, I don't know who I am. I don't have any self-confidence. How do I build it? How do I find out who I am? And a lot of times I said it's going through things, and first you'll find out what you don't like and what you don't want in your life. And yes, that can be discouraging, but the more you don't know what you don't want and don't like, you start realizing what you do like and what you will allow and accept in your life and what boundaries and standards you'll have.
Do you think that people can be helped through therapy as far as changing their feelings of self-worth?
Yes, definitely. I think definitely I've seen a lot of my clients, you know, do some incredible work. It takes some time because I think it's not, you know, it's the client figuring it out for themselves. It's them working through it. I can plant the seeds and give them different tools, but it's really about them. Again, you can tell someone 10 million times something about themselves. They won't believe it. But when they have that moment themselves and it clicks, it's a lesson that's stuck with them for the rest of their life. They're like, wow, okay, I remember that. And then that's how they form their who they are and all their belief systems, or what's kind of like a platform for them to move forward.
How do you deal with the issue of domestic violence when you have somebody come to you with that?
Number one, I definitely work with safety issues. I mean, is there, you know, an immediate safety issue? And with all my training with domestic violence is, you know, you cannot tell in any relationship. I never tell someone to end the relationship, leave the relationship. But with domestic violence, which is so dangerous sometimes, that's when a lot of, you know, the abuse escalates. So I really find where the woman or the man is and work with them, getting them a safety, you know, start building up their safety plan, getting things together for them. You know, is it getting the proper paperwork? Is it, you know, making sure their children are safe? Is it getting the bank accounts right? And really focusing on, okay, what is going on? You know, let's try and bring stuff together so you're not kind of, because when someone's in a domestic violence relationship, they've already been groomed so much that they don't believe anything is good about themselves, and they really believe the abuser. So it's really the letting this person know that they are worth, and this is not what life is all about.
I believe that when it comes to domestic violence, many people have a misunderstanding of it. And I am the first to admit that when I was younger, before I went to school, I misunderstood it also. Because I used to think to myself, why would somebody stay in a place where they're going to be hit? Where somebody's going to make them black and blue, or they're going to have broken ribs, and then they're going back for more? You know, what's wrong with them? You know, there must be something wrong with them. Maybe they get some kind of jolt after this. You know, people have a very bad misunderstanding about domestic violence. And I was having this discussion also with Dr. Walker that when you're involved with somebody with domestic violence, it doesn't start out that way. That many of these people who are involved as far as being, you know, brutalizing you, they start out as really great, personable guys. They win your confidence. You know, they build up your self-esteem. They love bomb you, and you really fall for them, not realizing that there's danger lurking, you know, because they're so complimentary. You know, and they can act a little, you know, possessive, but you think that's complimentary because they know who to hone in on. They know the kind of person who they can take control over. So it's not like it's just a coincidence. People, you know, these guys are predators, and they can sense your personality on how you'll react to them. Do you feel that's true?
Yes, yes. I mean, there was a study that they said predators can go into a room of children and make just by watching their the kids' mannerisms, they can pick which child they can abuse that they know wouldn't end up telling their parents just by mannerisms and body language, because they know what to look for, the low self-esteem, broken family, different type of histories, and then they groom them. And the love bombing and all of that, I mean, isn't that what we see on television, that this guy just loves you, he can't live without you, you're the best thing. It's like, yes, it's wonderful, and you get the butterflies, and you're all excited. But I think, you know, you don't want to be a Debbie Downer all the time, but you have to take a step back and saying, if it's too much too soon, it's sometimes a sign of a personality disorder.
Mm-hmm. How about women who say to you, it seems like I always attract these guys. Why are they always attracted to me? Do they come to you like that?
Yes, yes. And I think, you know, I think these guys can go to anyone, but they know sometimes who will kind of let them back in. And again, if they don't, you know, most of the time they don't come up to you on the first date and smack you. You know, it's very well groomed. It's something that, you know, the fight goes on and they push you, or they you know, do something to you, and then they cry and it's really horrible, and you already have this big connection and you're so in shock, especially if you don't have any exposure to domestic violence or borderline personalities, narcissists, psychopaths. You have no idea, and that's what kind of happens. You are so, like, confused and blindsided by this that you can never even fathom that this is what this person does on a daily basis.
I know that a lot of women keep thinking if they try harder to be better wives, if they, that, you know, they internalize the blame as being their own blame because these guys are telling them, you know, it's your fault. If only you were more this, if only you were thinner, if only you cleaned better, if only took care better care of the children, look how the house looks, you know, how do you expect me to, you know, so like they always make you feel like you're doing something wrong. And I think it's just a matter of time until you start feeling, well, maybe I am doing something wrong. Do you find that to be the experience?
Yes, and that with the isolation, a lot of that these abusers do, the isolation, cutting them off from outside support, you know, really kind of love bombing and then really start picking at them and doing these horrible digs at them really takes the person. It's almost like being in, like, you know, being in those camps during the war, and they would brainwash you and torture you, and you never knew when the, you know, what was happening. And I think that starts happening in domestic violence, and you start believing what they're saying. And when you don't have any other outside connections or exposures and people telling you, no, this is not what it is, you can. And I said, you know what, this is about the other person. No matter if you're the best wife in the world and you're the best cook, you dress nicely all the time, everything, you know, wild in the bedroom and all that stuff, it still would not be good enough, because this is about this person. This person is not happy with himself. There's a void in this person. This person will never, it has nothing to do with it. They'll never be satisfied. So it's really kind of taking the blame off you and saying this person has, it's only in this person. It has nothing to do with anybody else.
Mm-hmm. So let's say you're in a situation where you just feel overwhelmed. You're living in it. You're with a man who's overwhelming you every time you suggest maybe we should go for some help, and he just jumps down your throat and says, there's nothing wrong here. It's you. I don't have any problems. I mean, where do you start in those kinds of relationships? What do you tell women?
If their partner really is against, you know, working on it, and they're not ready to leave, or they're not ready to give up on the marriage and they still want to work on it, I would say definitely come into individual therapy. It might cause an issue. You can see if you want to tell your husband or not that you're coming in for therapy. But I think it's really you as a person. You don't have to make a decision overnight whether you're going to stay in a marriage or not. That's a big decision. So I think it's being able to come into therapy and really exploring and then saying, you know, is this person able to modify any of their behaviors? Are they willing to work on anything? I've had women that have come in, and men too, where their significant other is like, nope, it's all your fault. You have to change. There's nothing wrong with me. It's you. I will never do anything wrong. And I said, that they're telling you who they are. This is who they are. They've been doing this. They said they're not willing to work on themselves. They will not change anything. It's your fault. I said, so they're telling you who they are. They're not going to change no matter what. So either if you want to stay with this, but this is what you're getting. The person is telling you what you're getting. And if someone doesn't want to work on something or doesn't see a problem, then there's no work to be done.
And I think that's what women have to learn to accept, that there are certain situations that just can't get better no matter what you do. That when you're, and I just don't speak for women who are married to their gay husbands now, because many of them go on and have their next relationships, not with a gay man, but with someone who's really destructive to them. And I always say that you can't just run out, even though you may feel like now my marriage is over, now I can go and make up for everything that, you know, I didn't have. No, you need to really heal yourself, because when you're coming out of a relationship that's been a destructive relationship, where there's been trauma, where there's been emotional abuse, when you've lost who you are, you need to first find yourself before you can be ready to be with someone again. I always tell women that you can't be jumping out there after, you know, a trauma, or you're not going to find the right person for yourself. Would you say that's pretty true?
Yes, yes. I agree with that, too. I always kind of make the metaphor that it's like being having your own play, and you keep changing the lead actors in the play, hoping, but you never change the script. And every time the play is over, every time the movie's over, you're hoping that the ending's going to be different. But you didn't change anything. You just changed the lead actors. So it's like, you know, it's watching the same movie over and over again, hoping one day it's going to be a surprise ending when you already know what the ending is. So I think it's making sure you heal that. So, and even if it's a healthy relationship that ends, you need to heal and heal from and grieve that relationship before you're able to be 100% to be back into another relationship.
Mhm. And that takes time, wouldn't you say so?
Yes, yes. I think it definitely takes time. And I think you go through the stages of grief. You know, denial, bargaining, anger, depression, acceptance. I think it's really working through that and really allowing yourself and honoring yourself to go through that. A lot of times people say, oh, just get back on the horse, date someone, you don't have time, you better hurry up. But you're still carrying the same stuff with you into another relationship, which is not fair to the new person you're with.
I think that many of the women that are part of my support network will be the first to tell you that they came from homes where there was dysfunction. And they came from homes where there were problems. It could be alcoholism, drug addiction, mental illness. And they met their husbands, and it just looked like a better deal. Mm-hmm. Somebody there to love them, not really understanding the situation. Many of them were younger and didn't have a normal, quote-unquote, type of bringing up where they could judge anything by any kind of regular standard. So I tell women, you know, if you were broken to start with and then you go into a marriage that breaks you even further, you don't have to refind yourself. You have to first find yourself and who you are, because you don't even know who you really are. You know, it's one thing when you go into a marriage and you come in a position of strength and then you lose yourself, then you can find yourself again. But some women never even found themselves to start with, and so that's why I think this takes a long time. That is not something that happens immediately, overnight, or in a month or two. I mean, some people really are going to have to learn, you know, from the bottom up, because they haven't experienced any kind of positive relationships in their life. They went from a home situation that was destructive right into a marriage that was destructive, not understanding and thinking that everything's always their fault because they've been blamed, and then not having the confidence to even make it on their own. I think this is a really takes time, and a lot of people just don't seem to want to put in the time and the energy, I find. How about you, Alexa?
Yes, I find a lot of times, though, you know, people, you know, if they're coming from a dysfunctional family, if there's addiction or abuse in their family of origin, that, you know, someone comes along that looks like, you know, much better than where they are, but it's not the best, but it's at least maybe a step up.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they kind of do it out of safety concern, out of just trying to get out of that. And I think it's being able to, one, to be able to kind of sit with that, accept it, and not judge yourself for that. It happened,
mm-hmm.
It served its purpose, but to know that at any time moving forward, when you're not in such a crisis situation, make sure you're not making major decisions when you're in emotional turmoil. I always say, if you're in emotional turmoil, you're very upset, you're anxious, you're sad, you're angry, that is not the time to make a big life event decisions. You have to wait till you're at one point where you're calm, then make a decision. You never want to make a decision out of fear, out of desperation, out of anger. So you want to be able to say, you know what, I should not jump into another relationship just because of it. If you have to do it for safety sometimes when you're younger, something to get out of an abusive home, that happens. But I think then it's saying, okay, how do I now come from a place more of strength that I don't have to make these decisions anymore, and I really make sure I'm aware of the decisions that I'm making.
Mm-hmm. So if somebody really wants to make positive changes and they want to see a therapist, I always say that you need to have a connection. I think a lot of people who haven't had any experience with therapy meet the wrong therapist, and as a result, they quit. They think, it's not going to help me. I didn't have a good relationship. But I said, you can't quit there. If you don't make a connection with the therapist, then find another therapist. You know, I think people have that, their fear, well, if it didn't work out, then it must be me, or this isn't for me. So what do you suggest to them?
I think they have to make sure that therapy is for them. If they have any question in their mind or their gut says, and this is good for even relationships moving forward, if something's like, you know what, I really kind of didn't like what that person said. I really wasn't happy with that person's tone of voice when I told them this. Trust your gut. This is your therapy. If you're not happy with how they do therapy, their style of therapy, their mannerisms, it's okay. You don't even have to have a reason. If it just doesn't click, it doesn't click. Start paying attention to your gut instinct. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. Therapy has to be a place where you feel emotionally safe, where you can be vulnerable and not feel judged, so you're able to have a platform. You don't want to worry about what the therapist is saying, or the therapist is judgmental, or the therapist is telling me too much about themselves, or, you know, they have their own agenda, or they, you know, maybe are really strong on certain topics, and you can tell they have a bias to certain things. Then you're like, all right, you know what, that might not work for me. You have to find a therapist that you really feel very comfortable with, and sometimes you'll find it right away, and sometimes you won't. And it's good, you know, sometimes people want older therapists, younger therapists, male therapists, female therapists. It's your choice. This is about you, and you really have to pick someone that you feel comfortable with.
And I think that's the main thing, because you're not going to benefit from a relationship with a therapist if you can't be honest with the therapist for fear of being judged, or if you feel you're going to not being listened to in the way that you feel comfortable. Then that's not going for therapy. That's just wasting time. And I think that people have to realize that therapists are human beings. There's some great therapists like you, and then there's some therapists who aren't great because they just went through the motions and went to school and got their degree, and it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to connect with you. And you don't have to feel bad if you're not making connection with a therapist. You just have to go and
A therapist should never make you feel guilty if you don't want to continue working with them. I know a lot of therapists do, but they should never make you feel guilty. And they can say, if you'd like to discuss it, you know, is there something you'd want to talk about? I always honor my clients or anything that has ever happened. I tell them, even if they go away for 4 weeks and they're like, listen, I'm not going to be here for 4 weeks, do you mind? I said, I don't mind. I mean, this is you're not here for my approval. Thank you for telling me, but this is your therapy. You're not here. You know, you have to honor yourself.
Mm-hmm. So I think that's really important advice, because I think too many people give up on therapy because they don't make that connection with their therapist.
Mm-hmm.
So have you seen people really, you know, move from a very bad, dark spot in their life to really having happy and fulfilling lives?
Yes, I've
seen many
of my clients.
Over a period of time after they resolve trauma.
Yes. I have definitely seen many of my clients really start coming out on the other side and really, you know, starting to have a life. People who have never really left the house, who maybe didn't go to school, who didn't, like, do social activities, are now back out. And just feeling, knowing that, wow, I can actually be happy. They didn't even know what happiness was or what to really laugh. And to watch someone really find out what laughter is or joy in their life, it is rewarding. It's priceless. You can't even explain it.
And I think that's the important thing, to know that there is hope and that your therapist can be your weekly, you know, support team meeting, or, you know, every other week, whatever, you know, you can go to your therapist. But your therapist is really there to be your advocate, I believe. You know, to help you find your way into the happiness that you're looking for, and to help you resolve some of the issues that you're unclear about, and to really set goals with you. Would you say that's true?
Yes, I definitely agree. And I think the therapist is there for your goals, not the goals they think you should be working on, unless, of course, there's a safety concern. Then, of course, or addiction concern, then those, you know, that comes, that takes precedence. But I think it's about where the, meet the client where the client is. If the client wants to work on this and not, you know, wants to maybe work on their marriage but doesn't want to work on this, that's fine. You have to meet the client where they, in honor where they want to start the work.
Mm-hmm. How about children going for therapy? Do you suggest they go individually or as part of a family therapy? You know, what do you do as a therapist?
It also depends on the child and the parents. I have some children who want to come in alone. In the beginning, they don't want the parents there, and some parents want the children to go in alone, or sometimes they'll both come in for a little while, and then the parent or the child, one will say, okay, it's all right, you can be here by yourself. And I find it, both ways work, and I think it's, of course, what's best for the family. And I've had a lot of children that come in, and they talk sometimes more than the adults. They talk the whole time. It's amazing. That's what I really say. These children are very in tune in what's going on. They can talk a whole session and really tell you in depth of what they're witnessing. And sometimes the parents are like, they really don't speak at home. When they come into session, they know exactly what's going on behind closed doors.
And that's the point that I want to bring home again, is that it's so important for parents to realize that children know when there's unhappiness going on in a home. And this is nothing that you can hide from children. I mean, they're totally aware. They know when something's off. And also, you want to be role models to your children as far as what you want their future relationships to be like. And I always tell the women who are coming to me, I say, look, if you had a daughter and she's now grown up and you love your daughter, she's the most important part of your life, and she says to you, Mom, guess what? I met a guy just like Dad and I'm going to marry him. What would you tell her to do? Would you tell her, oh, that's wonderful, I can't wait till you have a marriage like I've had? Or would you tell her, run in the other direction and don't look back? Because if your answer is run in the other direction, if it's not good enough for her, then it shouldn't be good enough for you. Then you need to take those positive steps and be the role model and show her that you don't have to stay in a marriage that's destructive. Do you think that's true?
Yes, and I think it's finding out, what does she mean he's just like that? What are the positive traits? What are the negative traits? And what does she think she deserves, and what is she kind of overlooking, if she is, or putting up with just to be married?
Mm-hmm. You know, if children don't see love and affection in their own homes when they're growing up, you can't count on them watching the movies and the television shows and counting on that to be their guide. They have to see it in the home. They have to feel that love. They have to see that love. And that's how they're going to create their own lives for their own futures. And if they see that there's tension and there's hostility and put-downs and emotional abuse, that's something that they're going to be willing to settle for in their own lives, because that's the only modeling, that role modeling they know. Do you find that to be true?
Yes. They start thinking that's the norm, and they almost become immune to it. You build up a defense or an immunity or a tolerance for what is accepted and what is not accepted. And if, you know, even if the child doesn't realize they're doing it, but they end up saying, yeah, that happened in my house. But usually don't. It doesn't. It's not that bad. Because the more you're exposed to it, the more it starts becoming somewhat normal.
Mm-hmm. So the abnormal becomes your normal, and that's what you don't want to happen.
Yeah.
So, Alexa, if people want to buy your book, they can find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever great books are sold online. Finding Your Peace Within the Chaos. And the book is by Alexa Servadidio. It's a tough name to spell, Alexa.
I know. It's a tough one.
It took me about 3 years to learn it, but I have. I've definitely learned it. But you'll look for the book with a beautiful picture of Alexa on the cover, and you'll see that she's just as beautiful on the outside as she is on the inside. And once again, Finding Your Peace Within the Chaos. This is a book that really gives wonderful stories, wonderful insights, wonderful advice on what to do, and you can pick it up, like I say, online. It comes in paperback, and it comes on Kindle, every possible form of books, correct?
Yes, yes.
Okay, and if people are looking for a therapist in the Westchester area, they can find you, right?
Yes, you can find me on Psychology Today, or my number is 914-396-2435.
Right, and Alexa's also on our website, gayhusbands.com, under my links for people to go to when you're in trouble. Alexa, thank you so much for being my guest. I hope to get to see you this summer again.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Same here, and thank you. And good night to all of our listeners. Have a wonderful week. Good night.